think it's easy to say definitively how we should take Jacob, and that's a part of the beauty of the chapter.
Yeah,
I'm still wrestling with that.
Yeah, and I think for anyone who's reading literature, we should remember that no character is all good or all bad, right?
Right.
We're all mixed bags, but there are moments where there's a building of characterization or turning points where we see someone develop virtue or, you know, see device. So yeah, I'd be interested in how you see Jacob characterized in this narrative.
Yeah, yeah, and it all has to do with deception. And a lot of people pointed out that the word for deception in Hebrew is Ramah, and Laban is mentioned, called in Aramaean, which would be spelled in a really similar way, at least sounds similar, for the first time in chapter 31. And so deception lies underneath of all that's happening in Genesis chapter 31, and all of Jacob's story.
Welcome back to the Resurrection Church Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Shane Saxon. Shane is an associate pastor at Sturgeon Bay Community Church in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. He's completed an MDiv and a THM at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. But more importantly, Shane has been a guest on this podcast twice before. So Shane, you were on the podcast with me in episode 20 when we talked about genre, and in episode 38 when we talked about friendship. I should also mention that your wife has been on the podcast in episode 45 when we talked about classical education. But most recently, Shane has joined us at Resurrection Church, where he preached through Genesis 31. And I thought it was such an interesting sermon and an interesting text that I wanted to talk more with Shane about it. So Shane, thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Aaron, thanks for having me again. It is great to be speaking with you. It was great to be at the Res, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, so Shane, Genesis 31 is the text basically you preached. You didn't maybe cover every detail in the chapter, but at the start, you mentioned that it's one of your favorite chapters in the Bible or your favorite narratives. Why is that? What drew you to that narrative?
Dude, the Bible is so cool. Like, that is a premise for a lot of that comment, and that is, we had been preaching Genesis at our church here, Sturgeon Bay Community Church, where I'm an associate pastor, and I had been assigned Genesis 23 earlier in the year. And if you're not familiar, Genesis 23 is where Abraham buys the cave of Machpelah. And when I first opened it up, I'm like, how am I supposed to preach this? But then the more you dig into it, you're like, wow, there's just a lot going on here. So when I was assigned Genesis 31, it was a totally different experience, because right from the jump, there's really interesting stuff happening. But I would say there's probably five main things I love about Genesis 31. And even that number is a part of why I love it. There's just something there for everybody, you know? And so it appealed to kind of my eclectic interest. So one is, this is a unique chapter in Genesis because of the characterization. In the patriarchal stories, often the only real character is the patriarch. You know, even in instances where, like, Abraham is going down to Egypt, you know, maybe Sarah is a real character, and not in terms of, like, whether she was real, but in terms of, like, how much personality or characterization she's given in the story.
Yeah, so, but like, in literary terms, she'd be more of a flat character than a round character.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, the king of Egypt is also an object in that story. But in this story, you have two really significant characters, Jacob and Laban, and they're both characterized really interestingly. You know Laban from chapter 24 on, and the very first time you see Laban, Abraham Kuravilla pointed out that he's introduced when Isaac's servant, or actually Abraham's servant, sorry, is seen to be wealthy, and Laban notices. And so kind of like right away, you have a little bit of a sense of who this guy is. So I think that's really cool. Another thing about Genesis 31 is that right smack dab in the middle of Genesis 31 is you have this extended poetic dialogue. Jacob has a soliloquy, basically, and it's probably poetry. Most English Bibles don't bracket it out, but it has all the marks. Poetic diction, there's some rare forms. Ganufti is a rare poetic form for the, you know, a participle form for the word steal that people debate how we should take it, but it's just super rare. There's parallelism And then it also kind of leads in a poetic way. It's metaphorical language. So it's classic poetry, just like right in the middle of the chapter, which is really cool. Then you have the whole Rachel thing, which we'll talk about more, but is really fascinating. Both how it functions in my view, but also what happens. It's got the Shakespearean kind of grotesque humor thing going on, which I really like. And then also you have the whole Aramaean Jewish Israel thing. There's probably some etiology happening in this chapter. And so if you're interested in historical backgrounds, it's interesting. There's that classic part where Laban has two piles of stones, or the piles of stones, and Laban calls it Yegar Saduta, which is Aramaic, and Jacob calls it Gil-ed, which is Hebrew. But they both mean heap of witness, or, you know, mound of witness. And so there's also Aramaic, and some people have seen Aramaisms in Jacob's conversation with his wives in the first 17 verses. So there's just a lot in the chapter, and I love that.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you like this chapter?
Well, yeah, I want to circle back, though. You used a word that probably most people haven't heard, etiology. Can you kind of suss that out a little bit more, what you're getting at there?
Yeah, I think people use that word, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're the biblical scholar among us, that's a word that's used to describe when kind of the origin of a nation is being described. And so, you know, as Israel gains borders, it starts to become a people, and especially in relationship to other people. And so that's, I think, some of what's happening with the treaty at the end, where Laban is saying, us Arameans are going to stay on this side, and you Jews stay on that side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, obviously, etiologies can be explanatory beyond the origin of a nation. For example, in Genesis 2, Moses, if he's writing this, or however that tradition comes about, when there's that phrase that the man and the woman became one flesh, and this is why a father or a man leaves his father and mother, you know, it's kind of explaining the origins of marriage, and maybe in a precisely historical way, and maybe not. You know, I think that's one of the questions I have about this narrative, is how much of this is like a Van Gogh painting, where it's kind of filling in some of the gaps and providing explanation for the way that this early nation was founded, and how much of this was a pretty well-documented conflict in that nation's early history.
Yeah. Do you want to try to answer that?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that with each example in the Pentateuch, the way I would take it is always both. That these are things that happened, that Jacob and Laban really did have a conflict, and this is a formative event in Jacob's life, as he was a formative figure in the history of Israel. But that also the seeds of this, as it was being received, the authors noticed, oh, this is kind of how this border started. I didn't realize that. And they draw that out as they're telling the story. You know, so I think you don't have to choose one or the other. I think they can operate together.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I think one of the reasons I have that kind of question, though, is because the more that I've read Genesis, the more that I've noticed almost every narrative connects to a later Pentateuchal law. And as we'll talk about later in the story, you can't understand totally the imagery and the significance of this story unless you've also already read Leviticus through Deuteronomy, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's where I sometimes wonder how much of this is somebody going back and filling in some details, taking some literary license to be able to do so. I think ultimately it's probably not important, but I would imagine commentators kind of spend many pages talking about this kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of beauty to the story. You're drawn to it. I think everybody's sucked into it right away, especially if you've been reading along. Jacob, yeah. You know, it's interesting. Jacob's life is interesting because he is sometimes a guy who does things that are not admirable. And like every TV show, it's the characters that aren't doing everything right that get the most screen time.
That's
and
right.
Jacob gets a lot of screen time. So as we look into the background of Jacob's life, what's happened up to this point in his life that would bring us to this narrative where it even makes sense?
Yeah, so I think This is probably the section where I have the least to say, but basically, leading up to this point, Jacob, you know, famously is the younger of two twin brothers. Only the Lord speaks immediately after his birth and says that the younger will be served by the older, or the older will serve the younger. And then there's basically two major events that occur in Jacob's life. He kind of gets the birthright from his younger brother, from his older brother, and then he steals the inheritance from his father with the aid of his mother. And then he goes to his uncle, Laban, where the trickster gets tricked, and he works for 7 years, ends up with the wrong wife, works for another 7 years, gets the wife he wanted in the first place. And then Laban says, stay for 6 more years if you watch my flocks, and Jacob does. And then there's that whole weird thing with the spotted and speckled lambs, which are kind of important in interpreting Jacob's character. How you take that story will determine, I think, a lot of what you say about who you think Jacob is. But the only other thing worth mentioning, aside from those major stories that you're probably familiar with if you went to Sunday school and did flannel graph, is that between stealing the inheritance from his father and going to Laban, there is a vision, a dream at Bethel, at the house of God, where he pulls out a rock and he sleeps on it, and large rocks become a thing for Jacob. And there, he has a vision where a ladder appears and he sees angels ascending and descending. And what that means is interesting. And of course, it's received into the New Testament and becomes a really important symbol. But that happens in the middle of the two early scenes and then the Laban scenes. So I personally see that as kind of a turning point in his character. But that brings us up to where he is now. After the end of these 20 years serving Laban, Jacob runs, and that's what chapter 31 is about.
Yeah, and that's, I think, a good entry into this story. Obviously, there are some other details that might be good to keep in mind, like the marriage of Jacob to these two women, Leah, who doesn't seem to have any fertility struggles, and Rachel does, and they both contrive to have children in almost a pretty competitive way, apart from reliance on the Lord, and even using things like mandrakes, which maybe, you know, this guy at Southern, Jim Hamilton, calls this junk science, kind of like they read a mommy blog, you know, somewhere, and are trying to figure out how to use these fertility rites. And they ultimately attribute the children to the Lord blessing them, which is interesting to me. And I think that's the same when we get to Jacob with the spotted cattle and the way that he throws sticks in the water and these sorts of things. Again, maybe that's junk science, but let's talk about his characterization, because I kind of take a lot of these things is Jacob not depending on the Lord and not trusting the Lord, but really contriving his own way forward. And I wonder, even though he's received a word from the Lord in Genesis 31:3 to take everything and depart, it also pretty clearly says that Jacob deceived Laban. That's even apart from Laban's interpretation of the events, in which Laban says the exact same thing. I just wonder, did Jacob do the right thing in the wrong way? Like, what kind of Jacob do we have here?
Yeah, this is interesting. And I, you know, I don't think it's easy to say definitively how we should take Jacob. And that's a part of the beauty of the chapter.
Yeah.
Because I'm still wrestling with that.
Yeah. And I think for anyone who's reading literature, we should remember that no character is all good or all bad, right?
Right.
We're all mixed bags. But there are moments where there's a building of characterization or turning points where we see someone develop virtue or, you know, seed to vice. So yeah, I'd be interested in how you see Jacob characterized in this narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. And it all has to do with deception. And a lot of people have pointed out that the word for deception in Hebrew is Ramah, and Laban is mentioned, called an Aramean, which would be spelled in a really similar way, at least sounds similar, for the first time in chapter 31. And so deception lies underneath of all that's happening in Genesis chapter 31. And all of Jacob's story. Here's basically how I take Jacob, and it's a little different than you, and so we can kind of discuss this. And that is, I think that Jacob starts as the deceiver, and then I think from the point of the vision at Bethel, he begins to shift away from deceptive tactics and towards trust in Yahweh. However, I think that throughout, Jacob remains tricky, but I don't think he's maliciously tricky after he has that vision. So I think the climax of chapter 31 is verse 42. At the end of the speech, Jacob says, God saw me while I was working for you, Laban, and he prevented you from stopping me. So he credits his life to Yahweh. And specifically says that God saw him, which is an interesting thing to say, because you have this theme running through where Isaac's eyes are dim, and so that's why he can't determine who is in front of him. And then Jacob's eyes are dim when he's there on his wedding night and he doesn't know which wife that he's with. And now God has seen Jacob as he's been working for the last 20 years. But I think if you go backwards then, if you can defend chapter 31, I think you can, by saying that God stops Laban, that when it says he stole his heart, that it's using a different language, not a language of deception, but a euphemistic language to say that what he's doing is he's running for his life, and that he is attempting to get away from Laban in a crafty way, but a way he has to do in order to not be killed. Because as you've seen throughout, Laban is going to kill Jacob. You have to go backwards to the spotted and speckled lamb story and ask, was that deceptive? Was that junk science? And I think that, you know, people are super split on this. Like, is it junk science, or is it actually like proper breeding? And Jacob was like doing genetics, and that the like the sticks weren't really like magical. They were just like a part of the breeding process. I don't exactly know, but I do know that when Jacob is talking to his wives, he says that it was God who delivered them the lamb. In the same way, with the children, you know, look at what the children are named. Don. It's been determined, you know, by God. And each of the names of these kids reflect their reliance on God. And as you mentioned, they say, God gave us children. And then before that, it's the trickster being tricked, you know, so I don't really even see Jacob as being the deceiver in the situation where he's being taken advantage of by Laban and receiving the two wives. So I think that the arc of Jacob is actually kind of beautiful, because the best round characters are the ones that change dramatically, but then are still identifiable. You know, so like Ebenezer Scrooge at the end of A Christmas Carol, he's totally different than he was at the beginning of the story in terms of his character and how he comports himself. Mm-hmm. But he's still Ebenezer. You can tell who he is. And I think it's the same with Jacob. He's still tricky, but he's not the trickster. And there's actually maybe a theological direction you can go with this. There's this professor at Baylor who wrote an article, and he's written a monograph on Jacob. And his approach probably goes a little too far for what I'm comfortable with, but he basically argues that the point of the Jacob cycle is to show that Yahweh is tricky, and that Yahweh is so committed to his own ends and designs that he will be crafty in order to achieve them. And I think that that's a really interesting argument, because it shows that trickiness is essential to the Jacob story. But I think that there's a way to receive, to understand and identify craftiness in a way that's not malicious. And I think you have a great example in Greek literature. So Odysseus, you know, in the Odyssey, is always considered, you know, his tagline is he's shrewd. You know, he knows the plan. And in the Odyssey, it's like, yeah, Odysseus is our guy because he is crafty. But then in the Aeneid, right away at the beginning, there's this scene where Odysseus gets mentioned by a Trojan soldier, and they're like, Odysseus, he was crafty. And they mean it in a negative way. They're like, that guy was the worst. And I think that there's two sides to craftiness. There's a juke in football, and then there's lying and there's deception. And I understand Jacob as the former and not the latter. And that, I think, shows a character who's transforming, and his anti-character is Laban, who is not transforming. But Yahweh is the one preserving him. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make an interesting case, and I'm inclined to agree with the majority of it. You know, I do think that in the Old Testament, you see several instances where there's a kind of craftiness that could be interpreted as vicious deception, but it's actually virtuous, or at least as virtuous as possibly can be in that situation. And I think that's the case, perhaps, with Jacob and Esau and Jacob's mother. You know, when she has Jacob trick his father, it seems to me that she knows the promises of the Lord, and that the only way that Isaac is going to do the right thing is if she tricks him into doing the right thing. And so she, in a way, honors her husband by helping him do the honorable thing, which is to obey the word of the Lord. So I do have a category for trickiness or craftiness or deception that's ultimately righteous and honoring. And I think that's a challenge to some of our ethics, you know, especially recently, you know, I've heard some of Wayne Grudem's recent ethic book that argues it's never appropriate to lie or to deceive. Well, I think his ethical system would be challenged by these narratives. And I think even some of the narratives in Ruth, for example. So I very much agree with that. I also think that we do sometimes see God pictured as crafty, and in some explicit ways. So for example, in some of the Psalms, the prayers from the righteous about the unrighteous are, Lord, catch them in their own snare, you know, like allow them to be caught by their own actions, which takes a certain amount of trickiness. And I'm not against seeing God as crafty in a certain way. However, my pushback on that completely positive interpretation or mostly positive interpretation would be things like in Genesis 32, verse 2, when Rachel wants to be pregnant and Jacob becomes angry with her and says, am I God? You know, he's the one who's kept you from having children. And her immediate response is, take my maid Bilhah and sleep with her, and then God will give me children. So that's where I'd want to say, maybe it's not as clean cut. You know, they do attribute those children to Yahweh, but she's also circumventing what Jacob seems to be, say, is Yahweh's plan, which is that he's not letting you have children right now. So you just have to deal with it in a way. And I wonder if there's some of that in Jacob's actions as well. The other piece of pushback that I might have is that Jacob is consistently said to be motivated by fear of a person. So it's fear of Laban. He was afraid, and that's why he went about it in this way. And then in the next narrative, when he, in essence, deceives Esau, and I don't know if Esau was going to kill him or not with his 400 men, but he was afraid of Esau. So then he's like sending people up with gifts and then eventually breaks his word on where they're going to meet. So that's where I'd wonder if maybe there are some mixed motivations here, and it's not really a driving fear of Yahweh at play in his life.
I think it's certainly trajectory. Yeah, I think you're probably right. There's a debate to about how much Jacob is depending on Yahweh, and those two are good examples. He doesn't clear the false gods out of his camp for a couple more chapters. You know, so that's another piece that you could put in that argument. And so, yeah, I certainly don't want to say that I think Jacob's perfect, but I do think I see his action in 31 as self-preservation in a way that's reliant on Yahweh is really all that I would say firmly. And then I think beyond that, I think his trajectory is positive. Mm-hmm. And one other reason I would add that I was thinking this way is that this is how the early church received chapter 31, which is interesting. The ancient Christian commentary, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
They draw out how Chrysostom and Ambrose both read Jacob as kind of going out and being a man of virtue. And so he went home wealthy because he was clothed in his virtue that he had acquired while he was working under Laban. And I think that like so much early Christian exegesis, while at first it sounds like it's really far away from what's actually happening in the chapter, the more you think about it, you're like, you know, it's actually really close to what's happening here. You know, Jacob, he's working for 20 years, as he says himself, and he becomes a different kind of person. He becomes the kind of person who's reliant on Yahweh, as before he was taking matters into his own hands. And now he goes home quite wealthy because of Yahweh and because of some of the virtue that he has learned in in his subservience. And so I think the early church was seeing some of that. That got me thinking about it kind of at the outset as I was reading this chapter.
Yeah, and I think that's probably how some ancient Jews read it as well. I'd assume Philo read it pretty similarly. You know, that's how he kind of reads the Abraham accounts. Anytime there's someone who's called out by the Lord and they respond, there is sort of a commentary on like the migration of the soul and the gaining of virtue and these sorts of things. So I'm not totally against that. And I think we probably just have to receive the text with some measure of moral ambiguity. And in part of our duty in receiving the text is to enter into it and to feel around and sense that moral ambiguity. But also, I think we should be reminded that as much as Jacob has an important role to play, we're even more strongly drawn to think about God and the role that God has to play in this story. And one of the most clear ways that we know we should focus on that is we have Yahweh speaking to Jacob, and then we have Jacob's wife, Rachel, collecting Laban's household gods. And then there's this really tense scene, like TSA tense, where like maybe you have a knife in your backpack or something, and you're going to like not make your flight. Jacob has no idea what's going on. Laban is irate. Rachel gives an explanation for why she can't get off her donkey or cattle or whatever. What is she on? A camel?
It's camelback.
Yeah, she's on a camel. And talk us through this narrative, both about what it teaches us about Laban's gods and also what it teaches us about Jacob's God.
Yeah, this is fascinating. And this is really kind of the cream on top. You know, as I found this chapter interesting, and then as I started thinking about this, I'm like, wow, this is really awesome. And the artistry of the chapter, at least in the way that I take it. So there's just a question, and this is how I posed it in the sermon to try to kind of engage people in thinking about how to unravel this chapter. That is, why does Rachel steal the God? In the chapter, it just says that she does it. And so naturally, you think through motivations. You know why Jacob's running, because it seems like Laban's going to kill him. You know why Laban's running after him, because he's greedy and he wants to keep everything for himself. He feels like he's being stolen from. But why does Rachel steal the God? I mentioned a couple of reasons people have suggested. Here's a bunch of them. Okay, one person suggested that, this is the scholar maybe, said that the household God represents the authority of the paterfamilias. And so Rachel stealing it from Laban and giving it to Jacob anointed him as the authority figure. Maybe. You know, Chrysostom points out that Rachel didn't steal anything except for the household God. That's how deeply ingrained in ancestor worship that she was. You know, so maybe. You know, Josephus says that Rachel steals the household God so that if they get captured, she has something that she can ransom for her life. Rashi, he said that Rachel was stealing the God to try to get Laban to stop practicing idolatry, that Rachel had become a Yahweh worshiper. Ibn Ezra said that Rachel didn't want Laban to use the God's power of divination, which is referenced in the previous chapter, so that he could find them when they're on the run. And then, yeah, I think one other suggestion is that Rachel is questing, it's similar to the maybe suggestion, but that Rachel is attempting to actively subvert Laban's authority into household God. Do you find any of those compelling?
You know, this is one of those situations where I think a lot of Second Temple literature tries to fill in the gaps by adding details. And this is like the kind of thing that I would want to add in details to. And your guess would be as good as mine, which would be as good as anybody else's, basically. And I wonder if it's the kind of scene where we shouldn't be asking, why did Rachel do this? But why did the narrator include this detail in the story? Because if we were rewriting the tale, in one way, we could excise that detail and excise Laban searching for the household gods, and not too much would be missed. Because Laban could still go after them because he didn't get to kiss his children and grandchildren goodbye. You know, we could still have this scene in a way. So yeah. Why would the narrator include this detail?
I think that's exactly right. And as you're reading these explanations, everyone's offering evidence, you know, so-called evidence. So nobody is saying like, it's never presented as pure speculation, even though you're right. It's usually speculative. Until I came across an article written by a feminist scholar who is arguing that no details about Rachel's motivation are included because often female characters in the Bible are not attributed motivation, and it's a sign of the lack of agency that female characters have in the Bible. And that's an interesting suggestion. You know, I don't think it fully holds up if you look at other characters and stories in the Bible.
Well, not to mention that in the chapter previous, she has so much agency that she can, like, barter with another wife for sex rights over her husband. Yeah. So, like, I think a lot of feminist scholars do a good job shedding light on certain features of Old Testament text. But on the face of it, you know, I've never read that article. Maybe I'd be convinced after reading it. But I see Rachel as someone with so much agency throughout this text that would be difficult for me to believe.
I agree with you. However, she makes an observation. There's no details about Rachel's motivation in this chapter. And that's exactly right. Like, that is an exactly accurate observation. And that pointed me to your conclusion. That is, okay, trying to figure out why Rachel stole the idol is the wrong question. Why did the author include this narrative? And then once it unfolds, you see, ultimately, the god being sat on by a woman, being bled upon, and which is defiling according to Old Testament law. And there's an interesting resonance with Isaiah 46, 1 and 2. In Isaiah 46, the prophet talks about the idols stooping low on the donkeys. And, you know, that these false idols are being carried around by donkeys. And there's some irony at play there. And it's a similar thing here, where there's an irony about the author thinking through, like, what even is a god that it would be sat upon by a woman and defiled? And especially when you contrast that with Yahweh's action in the story to stop Laban, who ostensibly has his sons with him who have never been mentioned before, chapter 31, but now they're brought into the story. And just based on timeline, these are grown men. And you know that Jacob doesn't have grown men with him. I mean, at most, he's got 20-year-olds. And they can't be that old. They're 14-year-olds. And so Jacob's at risk here of being killed. And this is interesting because this is a little bit of a side narrative, but did you know that at the Passover Haggadah, before they say Pesach, or before they celebrate Pesach, there is a line in the Haggadah where they say Laban tried to kill Jacob. But nowhere in chapter 31 does it actually say that. Do you remember the scripture reading I had us read from the Old Testament, Ed?
No, I have no memory of that, unfortunately.
So in Deuteronomy 26, there's a line where it says, "A wandering Aramean was my father."
Yeah.
Now, this is a little technical, but the word wandering there is the word oved, which in the Hifil, in a different stem, can mean to kill. And so if you repoint it in the Hifil, which I think is possible, as I was looking at it yesterday, you might read that, and some early translators or readers of the text took it as an Aramean killed my father or attempted to kill my father. And so they would say that was Laban, and that ended up in the Haggadah. That's really interesting because they're reading this story with Laban being this guy who says to Jacob, "You abducted my children," but in the reality, he's the one who's coming to kill Jacob. And so all that to say, I think it sets up this conflict where Yahweh is powerful, and then the only other god in the story, mentioned by Laban at the end of the chapter when he swears by the gods of Nahor, and his father, is that what he says? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but you know, like, your comment there makes me again see a connection between later Old Testament law that might inform our reading, because it would seem that if Jacob actually had abducted Laban's children and grandchildren, then Laban would be within his rights as a redeemer of blood or kind of the man in the family to go and execute justice against Jacob. So it almost seems like Laban is setting things up to where he could basically say, in a court of law, I am not guilty for murder if I kill you. And I don't know what you would make of that.
Yeah, I don't really read Laban as like Torah observant. And so I didn't really follow that particular line of as I was reading the story, but it's certainly possible, and it's certainly whoever was reading this or the people, as you mentioned, were aware of Old Testament laws, and they certainly do connect Laban as a kinsman. Jacob says that himself. He says, "Search among your kinsmen and my kinsmen,"
mm-hmm.
And Jacob says himself, "If you find the person with the idol, you can kill them." But Laban's target is on Jacob when he first initially comes, and so that some of the question is, was Laban coming to actually kill Jacob? That's probably not clear, and that's a misreading of Deuteronomy 26. But you know, Jews today still say that, and mm-hmm. so it seems to get at some of the heart of the chapter.
Yeah, interesting. And yeah, I don't see Laban as Torah observing either. In a sense, neither was Jacob, because Torah had not yet been given. But I think if you just look at ancient law codes, probably there's this general sense of morality that Laban is leaning into. I don't know. Yeah. I'm speculating here. I don't know anything about Genesis. That's not my field of study.
Isn't it exactly your field of study?
Well, just the first chapter. Yeah, okay. So we've talked some about Jacob and Jacob's God versus Laban's God. And I think kind of the main point that you were getting at in your sermon is that God keeps his promises and he vindicates Jacob. Is there anything you'd like to kind of say about the final portrayal of Jacob's gods versus Laban's gods?
Yeah, so I was just going back to look at it. It's the God of Nahor, which is the brother of Abraham. It's the mm-hmm. God of the father of Nahor. And so that's Terah. You know, they came out, they were called out. And so Abraham being called out from this, you know, theoretical polytheism or whatever, it's not Yahweh worship. And that's who Laban serves. And so when Jacob says at the culmination of his speech, "It's Yahweh who saw me," I think that that's the climax, because it was Yahweh who stops Laban on his way, appears to him and says, "Don't say anything good or ill." And Laban says, "I could have killed you, but God said not to." And given that Laban clearly isn't a Yahweh worshiper, he has false gods in his home, he swears by false gods, I think that's a sign of Yahweh's power. And I think ultimately, while Jacob is a really cool, round character, I think he is transforming and changing. It's ultimately, like you said, about Yahweh and his power first and foremost. And that's the catalyst for Jacob's change, is increased recognition that Yahweh is with him. And that's what he learns when he's on the way to Laban and has that vision by Bethel, that Yahweh's with him. There's a ladder. And God, he says, God is in this place. He's come down to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And I think there's something like a recapitulation of Abraham's life, where Jacob is called out from the gods of his fathers to worship Yahweh and to go into the land. So you really are seeing Abraham's life relived in Jacob, and you're hoping that he's going to take on the faith of his father, Abraham. And that maybe leads us into this moment where Jacob refers to his God as the God of Abraham and the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac. And I think that phrase, the fear of Isaac, is really unique. I think only used twice in the Old Testament. And I think even in the second time, it's not exactly the same as the first, if I'm remembering correctly.
Both in this chapter.
Yeah, both here. What does that phrase mean? And I know it's translated differently in different translations, but how do you take that phrase? And is that a designation that we ought to be using for?
I think that would be really cool. There's this one theory I stumbled across that one critical scholar argued that there's originally three gods that are being brought together in Genesis.
Yeah.
The God of Abraham, the Elohim of Abraham, the terror of Isaac, the fear of Isaac, and the mighty one of Jacob. Which is mentioned later in like chapter 49, I think. I don't think that holds up at all, but it's an interesting
theory. Yeah, for the record, neither do I. But I have thought that's interesting. Typically, people who come up with these theories, you know, they're not completely unfounded, but they are trying to explain how there came to be one God, and they're trying to pull together strands of what look like could be different religions and different names for deities. it makes sense. Somebody who's not convinced of the Old Testament's telling of Israel's history, it makes sense that they would go down that route. But for listeners who might wonder, where is that coming from? I think even the distinct use of names, sometimes scholars will take as indicating distinct authors who are referring to the same God by a different name. But then other scholars will look at these different names as separate gods who become merged into the one God of Israel. Is that right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I agree with you. Ultimately, that like the whole theory of the Pentateuch being like a mix mash of different things is based on different names for God, ultimately. And it just doesn't hold up. There's different reasons why the same author would call God different names. And in this this particular instance, though, it's really curious because the language itself is kind of fraught. So this is a little bit of a technical discussion, but if you'll indulge me, the word for fear here is this word pachad. And this is not the normal word for like awe or reverence. So I have a story for you, Aaron.
Yeah, I'd like to hear it.
When I was studying modern Hebrew, I was able to have this interview in front of the class. We were all supposed to talk with this lady who was an Israeli and ask her a question. And so it was right when COVID broke out. And I asked her, are you afraid of COVID? Because that was like happening at that moment. And there's two words in Hebrew for fear. And I used the other one, not the one used here, yare. And I said, are you afraid? And the professor in all the class kind of laughed at me because she's like, what are you talking about? You sound like a goy. And it's because the word hifhid today, the word pachad, is the word for like fear of danger, not fear or reverence like yare. Now they overlap a little bit. So it's not like you can't say that they're not, that there isn't some overlapping difference. But in English, we use the word fear for both like awe, reverence, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, and for fear of danger. So there is really in the Pentateuch, there is never an instance where the word pachad is used of Yahweh. In the prophets, there is, and so that's interesting, but it's always Yahweh. And so some people, William Albright, suggested that the word pachad is related to a Semitic cognate, that is a word in other Semitic languages that means thigh. And then he went on to suggest that that word also can mean kinsman or family. And so he says actually that this word is referring to the kinsman of Isaac. Now, for those of us who are writing dissertations on family metaphors in Genesis, that might be an interesting suggestion because he's picking up on the theme that God has a special familial relationship with those who he chooses. And so Isaac is calling Yahweh his kinsman. However, that connection to the Semitic cognate doesn't work on morphological grounds. The change doesn't work. It wouldn't be normal for the ways that words get borrowed and moved around. Hmm. And also that meaning of kinsman is a stretch.
Okay. So that would be pretty dope because there would be a great intertextual contrast between the household or kinsman God of Isaac and Jacob and the household God of Laban.
Yes. So it's been attempted to be rescued by this guy named Malul, who wrote in 1985, and he suggested that the word thigh itself, which does exist in Hebrew, was borrowed from Aramaic. You see it in Job 40:17 when he's talking about Leviathan. May work, even if it doesn't mean kinsman, it euphemistically can be used, right? Because mm-hmm. you swear by the thigh. Now, usually, you swear by the yerek, not the pachad, but they both mean thigh, and in the Bible, there are other leg appendages that get used euphemistically. You know, so famously, mm-hmm. the reglaim, the feet, are used euphemistically in Ruth. And so what they've suggested, and what Malul goes all the way into, like, comparisons in ancestor worship and other things like that, I don't think you have to go that far. I think you can recognize that they swear by the thigh because it's close to the loins, and it's representative of the way that God's blessing is necessary in order for there to be posterity. And so when do they bless, you know, make a covenant by the thigh? When Isaac is dead and old and he's weak, and, you know, he needs some help to have posterity. And so that's mm-hmm. when the it is made. And so you could say something like the thigh of God or something like that, you know, the strength that creates posterity or secures the blessing of posterity. That's an interesting theory. And I
love that theory, Shane. I think that is great. I like that better than what you explained in the sermon.
I'm not sure if it holds up, but there's actually even a further evidence for it. And that is some people have seen that Jacob, even in his conversation with Rachel and Leah in verses 1 through 17, uses some kind of odd Aramaic expressions. And then what I mentioned before is that there's an Aramaism at the end of the chapter when Laban says Yagar Saduta, and the word for thigh here is Aramaic. And so this could be another example of an Aramaism, and the author could be kind of making Jacob, could be recording Jacob speaking kind of Aramaic / Hebrew, you know, like a mixed mm-hmm. language, that because he spent 20 years there kind of coming enculturated. So that could be a...
Yeah, linguistically, yeah. That would not be unheard of. You know, yeah. I think we know people who speak multiple languages, and that sometimes happens.
My only problem is that it's all based on the idea that the patriarchs wouldn't be afraid. The normal word that's used many, many, many times is fear, the fear of Isaac. And, you know, that the one who Isaac is afraid of. And I think that there is a very real sense in which Yahweh is dangerous, you know, and I think that's why Robert Alter's suggestion that we should translate this, the terror of Isaac, has a certain kind of, like, you know, that puts it in a way that that makes sense to me of what it's getting at. And that is, genuinely, you should be terrified of Yahweh. He can appear in the night and stop you in your tracks. Even if you've got a banding of marauders who's going to go and kill Jacob, you know, mm-hmm. He is someone that you ought to be afraid of. And even though it's not mentioned by other patriarchs, certainly other patriarchs are filled with fear at Yahweh.
Yeah. And I, you know, even though I like the family God view a little bit better, it does make sense. Even when you're looking at Genesis 31:42, you know, I'll read from the NLT, but remember that Jacob's been fleeing Laban because he's afraid of Laban, but I think he can almost use this as a threat against Laban, saying, I've been afraid of you, but you need to be afraid of my God. So he says, you know, you've changed my wages 10 times. In fact, if the God of my father had not been on my side, the God of Abraham and the fearsome God of Isaac, you would have sent me away empty-handed. But God has seen your abuse and my hard work. That is why he appeared to you last night and rebuked you. So I think that does work really well. I don't know if you'd see that as kind of a divine oath threat leveraged from Jacob against Laban, but it seems like that's probably what's in view.
Yeah, I think so. But it's interesting to think about. There's actually a third alternative.
Okay.
But it's much shorter, and that is there's a cognate that this in Arabic that the substantive would mean refuge. And so a few commentators say the refuge of Isaac. And there's a name in Hebrew that is Tsel Pachad, and that's the shade of protection. And it's built off of that cognate. And so that would be an example of that. So some people have gone that direction. It's a little speculative.
Yeah, I think probably for each one of those three main options, you could make a pretty convincing case to somebody. So, yeah. You know, how do you determine when there are three interesting and compelling options?
Yeah, so as I was trying to unpack this, what I start with is kind of this word. How often is it used in the Bible generally, and in what context? You know, I'm starting with that discrete word. Not that you can use that word every instance of it. It doesn't mean the same thing, but you are going to develop a sense or range of meaning. And so I want to start there, but then also I want to try to find the simplest explanation. And so that is what ruled out some of the etymological connections. Some of the etymological, like this is a cognate of that can be really helpful, especially because we have such a small corpus of literature in the Old Testament that just because it's only used once in the Bible doesn't mean it wasn't a relatively common word. You know, we have a really small base of literature compared to something like Greek, where we have so much literature and so much background for each word. But there's been a little bit of a correction against these creative etymological solutions, because the etymological fallacy is really, really easy to commit. Because a word meant something in the past doesn't mean it means that now. And there's tons and tons of examples of that. Usage determines meanings. And so as I was reading chapter 31, I was picking up on what you suggested. God is striking fear in Laban's heart. It makes sense that Jacob would call him a fear-creating God. And then I think the broader context that Yahweh destroys the earth with a flood. He strikes down Egypt and levels the greatest nation in the world. He certainly inspires fear, and the prophet Isaiah recognized that. And so those are some of the ways that I kind of tackled that problem.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I agree with your conclusion. This designation had been used earlier in the narrative, like in closer proximity to Laban looking for his household God. And if Jacob denied it, saying, look, I worship the God of my father and of Abraham and the, you know, fear of Isaac, then maybe we would be on firmer grounds because of what he's doing with that statement. But here it does seem to me that he's trying to put fear into Laban's heart. So that makes sense. So as we move on to the story, you know, the story ends with some resolution, but you get the sense that it's not fully resolved. So Jacob and Laban sit down and they make this covenant together. But throughout, Laban has been speaking to Jacob, even though he has admitted that God came to him and said not to say anything to Jacob, good or bad. I don't know how much to make of this, because without Laban speaking, there wouldn't really be this story at all. Laban doesn't get struck down dead by God for disobeying or something like that. How do you take this? How do you understand Laban speaking good and bad to Jacob?
Yeah, so I didn't investigate this a lot the first time through. And so, you know, I'm curious to hear what you think, because Robert Alter suggests that this is just a normal expression for don't harm someone. And so I didn't really think about how the what he's saying there literally is being transgressed. And, you know, to divide the literal and metaphorical understanding is to kind of take metaphors the wrong way. You know what I mean? If we separate those two cleanly, we're not really understanding how metaphors work. So I like your suggestion, but I hadn't thought about it too much. So I looked at it a little bit. And this phrase, as far as I can tell, is really only used two other times. And they maybe actually add a little bit of grist to the mill to see if there's something going on here. And that is, this expression is used by in describing the encounter between Absalom and Amnon after Amnon and the Tamar story happens. And Absalom, you know, hates Amnon, but it says that Absalom didn't say anything good or evil to Amnon. And that probably means literally he didn't say anything to him and he didn't harm him, because he didn't respond to Amnon when Amnon talks to him. And so that could go either way. The only other time that I could find, and someone call in if they have a different instance, it's actually Laban and his father, Bethuel, when Abraham's servant is there negotiating for Rebekah, the servant says, you know, do you guys have any opposition to me taking Rebekah? And they say, we can't speak good or evil. It's been decreed by God. And that was interesting. I hadn't noticed that before. It's the same exact expression. And I had taken that in the past without really thinking about it too much. It's just like, hey, God said, you know, it's been decreed. But maybe there's a sense in which we know Laban and Bethuel, Aramaean, polytheistic, based on this later story, are not Yahweh worshipers, even if they maybe account for Yahweh in their divine counsel. Maybe they're not saying good or evil because they wish they could, but they know that he's too powerful and that they need to just give up Rebekah to obey God. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting going back to that earlier use with Laban and his father, because it's another instance where one of their family members is leaving. And so, yeah, I'm not quite sure what to make of it. I have wondered if it is a figure of speech and we shouldn't be overly literal when we read that and indict Laban for disobeying God, because he might be acting in conformity to whatever that figure of speech means. And I think there's a good caution that we shouldn't overread the Bible. We shouldn't kind of read too hard, especially in these narrative texts, and especially texts where we don't have the same cultural phrases, all of these sorts of things, you know. But I have wondered, the way that Laban keeps repeating this phrase, he feels like he's in the right. It's almost like he's defying God to a certain degree. And I think with the battle of the gods there between his household God and Jacob, it's almost part of Laban's characterization, where he's so blind to the true God that he's going to reject the true God who spoke to him while his God is being defiled by a woman. So I don't know that we should make too much of it, but it definitely portrays Laban as somewhat arrogant, I think.
Yeah, I think so. All throughout, there's an arrogance and an evil, and that's what makes Laban so great. I didn't realize he's just like an arch villain until I really was diving into this. And he is. He's the great arch villain of the book of Genesis, and the Jews recognize that. That's why they say that prayer in the Haggadah.
Yeah, dude, I think he's like a precursor to Pharaoh in Exodus, because the very first time that he sees Abraham's servant, he realizes that this guy's wealthy. Like, he's coming with money. And so he's ready, if he can, to barter his sister for the money, in a way. I think he's always out to increase his stores, even at the oppression of other people. And Jacob, who will later be named Israel, right, is basically in slavery to Laban for 7 years plus. You know, it keeps getting added up. And that's exactly what Pharaoh's going to do once he forgets about Joseph to the Israelites. He's going to enslave them and profit off of their labor and God's blessing on them. So yeah, I think that we should look at him pretty negatively. And similar to the way that Moses, on behalf of Yahweh, speaks to Pharaoh, telling him what to do from Yahweh, and Pharaoh refuses to do it, I think we have something very similar with Laban. But not quite, because he gets away with his life. I don't know that Pharaoh and his henchmen do. But there's a covenantal meal, and Laban gets to participate in it with Jacob. They make a covenant together. What's the significance of this meal? And are there connections between this covenantal meal and any later covenantal meals?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked this question, mainly because after I preached, we were having lunch, and you were like, "Hey, man, I just don't see it." And I was kind of hurt.
Okay, I don't think I was that forthright. I think I said, you know, I'd like more details on kind of how you're making a bridge between this covenantal meal and the Lord's Supper.
So, do you remember the story with Isaac and Abimelech? And Isaac pulls an Abraham, and he lies about his wife, and then eventually it becomes clear to Abimelech, because of God, that he has stolen the wife of a man. And so Abimelech is very angry. Well, that story ends, and then there's the scenes with the wells, and where Isaac, you know, recovers wells and moves around and gets a few wells. But then there's this really interesting thing. Abimelech and the commander of his army, Phicol, come to Isaac, and they say, "Hey, clearly God is with you. We should make a covenant." And this is interesting, given kind of what we talked about with the etiology point. This is the king of the Philistines. So this is the southwestern portion of Israel. And Philistines would have been one of the major enemies. And it mentions at the beginning of that chapter that God told Isaac, don't go down to Egypt, even though there's famine in the land. Anytime there's famine in the, you know, Palestine region, they're going to go to Egypt, because in the Delta area, they have rain that doesn't come from the sky, you know? It's the Nile. And so they can have food year-round. That's why it makes sense to go there when there's famine. That's why Joseph and his brothers, all of that occurs. But Isaac doesn't go, and water is provided, and the Philistines recognize that. And so Abimelech says, let's make a treaty. So now you're establishing the border. You're starting to see that there's a nation being formed. But what do they do after they make the treaty? They sit down for a meal. And so it appears as though when there's a covenant treaty made, that a part of the covenant treaty is for the parties of the treaty to sit down together for a meal. And so I don't just see it as a meal. I see it as a covenant feast, and I see when the meal occurs, you know, it doesn't explicitly say that Laban is at the meal, but it says that he sat down with a kinsman, and Jacob labels Laban as kinsman. And so I see this as Laban being there because it's a covenant feast. Derek Kinder called it a covenant feast as I was kind of reading the commentaries, and that got me thinking about this. And I think it's because he's picking up this pattern that when a covenant is made, they always have a meal. So once you establish that, then I think you have to understand the significance of why would they have a meal with a covenant? Well, when you're establishing a covenant, you're making certain mutual promises that incur mutual obligations. And so mutuality is core to the covenant. We are both upholding aspects of this agreement for each other. There's going to be a mutual loyalty. And at a meal, two people who are both hungry share in food to meet their basic needs. We're both hungry, we're both thirsty, and at this table, we're equals because we both need to eat. And so the table operates as a leveler. It brings two people, the king of the Philistines and this wandering dude who is out by himself, are now equal. And it's not just King Abimelech. It's also the commander of his army, and they're sitting with him. And the same thing is operating in Genesis 31. Laban has had the upper hand this whole time. Laban is with his sons. He could kill Jacob, but now he's sitting at the table. And especially given that Laban has made agreements with Jacob and broken them over and over and over again, that, you know, in this sermon, I labeled those contracts because I'm trying to show that Laban was the guarantor, and Laban kept on breaking his own word. But in the covenant, God is the guarantor. And so they can both sit at the table. So once I saw both of those things, then I'm not necessarily saying that the author of the Pentateuch was thinking of the Last Supper when he drew up the feast, but I was thinking that we were about to participate in a covenant feast. In a situation where all of us who are hungry for righteousness and thirsty for the kingdom of heaven are going to sit down, and whether we're oppressors or oppressed, we will all sit at this table because we're all needy for Jesus, and we'll all take of the divine food. We'll all feel the presence of Christ poured out for us on the cross and have our faith deepened and enriched because of what he did on the cross. In the same way that Jacob and Laban are brought in equal footing, and because of the Lord's protection and providence, they are equalized and both dependent on him and his protection ultimately to uphold that covenant, that the Arameans wouldn't come in and wipe out the Israelites, or that the Israelites wouldn't in the same way go out and wipe out the Arameans. They're dependent on Yahweh that his plans would succeed in the same way we are when we celebrate the Lord's Supper. So that was some of the thinking behind the connection, but in a sermon, you don't have as much time to lay it out. Does that satisfy you?
Yeah, I think if you had said all of that in the sermon would have been way too long, but I would have been more satisfied about the connection that you made. I obviously agree that this is a covenantal meal, and I take it sort of as proven that typically covenants are kind of include a meal, kind of a feast of celebration and equanimity between the two parties. So yeah, I see a lot of connection there. And I think the value of recognizing that connection is not so much as seeing it this is a type of the new covenant meal to come or the marriage supper of the Lamb, but shedding light on the meaning of covenantal meals. And I think as we recognize the way that enemies become equals and inferior and superiors become equals and everything else, all the differences are kind of evened out at this sacramental meal, this covenantal meal. When we come to the table every Sunday, we're sort of pledging to one another good faith, relationships under the fear of Yahweh. And we're pledging to one another kind of an equality in Christ that we share with one another. So I think it's really informative for the way that we think about the Lord's Supper, but I'd want us to look at it as informing our concept of covenantal meals, not trying to do some quasi-biblical theology tracing of a covenant meal and saying, look, here's the foreshadowing of the new covenant meal. I don't know if that lands with you or not.
Yeah, I think I would have to think more about how you're distinguishing those two kind of hermeneutical or exegetical moves. Did the kind of accumulation of covenantal meals that are presented in the Old Testament inform the importance of covenant as a theme going into the New Testament, which then leads to Jesus' use of that metaphor as a significant part of his kind of message to us at the last table? I would probably say yes, and in that sense, it's a typology. But does this foreshadow, you know, so I don't know, how is that different than what you're saying?
Yeah, I think what I'm saying is it doesn't so much foreshadow as it fills in the meaning of covenantal meals generally. And as we recognize the Lord's Supper as a covenantal meal, we can grab onto that meaning. And I think if we attend to the differences in this meal, it makes the typological foreshadowing a little bit more difficult. So for example, right before this meal, Jacob and Laban are swearing to one another. And Laban says, "Your God and my gods are going to watch over us." Well, at the Lord's table, at the Eucharistic covenantal meal, we're not saying anything about the pagan gods who are contributing to the unity that we share with one another. So I'd also just want to look at some of these differences and say that there are better covenantal meals that could be typological precursors of the Lord's Supper. For example, the covenantal meal that Moses and the elders had before the Lord. Like I would look at that as a typological meal. This I would not look at as a typological meal. And maybe this is splitting some fine hairs, but I just maybe want to notice the differences as well as the similarities.
Yeah, fair. It's certainly not a one-for-one comparison, you know, and even getting into, you know, the nature of the covenants, there's a lot of complexity there. It's interesting that when Jacob begins to give his poetic dialogue, he says that he reeves, you know, reeve being that famous word for covenant, and that's what he gives his speech about. But then it's God who vindicates him, and that vindication is celebrated at the table. So that may be another, you know, just a way that the covenantal aspect of the meal is being brought forward. But yeah, I agree with you. There's significant differences.
Yeah, so we've walked through this story. You know, it took me 8 minutes to listen to it on my Dwell Bible app, and we've talked about it for an hour and 8 minutes. And I think it would be important for us, as we conclude, to think about how we ought to respond to this text. How should those of us who are receiving this narrative so many centuries later respond to the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac?
Yeah, so the main application of the sermon that I preached at your church, which I think is true, is that we should all trust in Yahweh. And especially if we feel oppressed, underprivileged, alone, like Jacob did, we feel passed over, manipulated, trust in Yahweh. He's greater than any circumstance. He's greater than any oppressor. He's greater than any bad boss, and you should trust in him. And so I think that still holds up as a great application. But I think another way to kind of shed light on that application is I always think about kind of how people would have read and received these stories. We know that people were receiving these stories in the exile because one post-exilic prophet, Malachi, says, talks about Jacob and Esau and interprets this story in a very particular way. Not Genesis 31, but the Jacob and Esau story by his main metaphor being, Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated. And so I was thinking, you know, how would people then have read this story? And it's interesting that for people who got taken away from their home, who were ripped out of everything that they knew, but then while they were being oppressed and enslaved, they came closer to Yahweh than they ever were before. As Ezekiel says, God says, I was present to them, not you, the ones who were remaining in Jerusalem. He says, I was present to them. And then they come home with a greater sense of their identity. They know who they are as Torah observant Jews after the exile. And I wonder how much they were reading stories like this and they were thinking about who they ought to be as they face the manipulation and the oppression of the Babylonians, that they ought to be the kind of people who trust in Yahweh above and beyond any of the things that they see around them, and that they should learn to depend on him wholly because he would vindicate them in the end. And that seems to be the message that a lot of the prophets were preaching, is that if you rely on Yahweh and not on anything else, then he will vindicate you in the end. And I think that that's the message for us today, and that's the message of much of the Bible, and that's the message of Genesis chapter 31.
Yeah,
what do you think of that?
I mean, it's interesting that you go to Malachi, because the reason that quote is there, or why that line is there, is because the audience is saying, you haven't loved us. You know, in what ways have you actually loved us? So I would kind of take it at a different angle and say that there were people who are saying God hasn't loved us. Even though Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated, it doesn't seem like he's actually loved us. And I think probably Jacob had moments in his life where he could have said the same thing in all of his years of servitude to Laban, perhaps. And I think it's a reminder that even when God doesn't love us, or we don't feel like God loves us or pays attention to us, we have an obligation to walk in the fear of Yahweh, knowing that he does, and he does see, and he will eventually vindicate us. So I think there's like two sides of that. There's the confidence in the vindicating power of Yahweh, but there's also a moral responsibility to that God when it doesn't seem like he's exercising the power on our behalf. And I think that's what's going on a little bit in Malachi, where we can be tempted to say, if God's not going to do it for me, then I don't have to do anything for him. And there's a reminder that God will vindicate you in his time, but you have to be faithful while you wait.
Yeah.
Does that land?
I think it does. It does. Because I think that that's like what the prophets and what Genesis, the way it's functioning for them, is not to say, you know, that you're going to feel, you know, that they're going to feel close to God. It's calling them to depend on God. It's calling them to be like Jacob. It's not saying that they are Jacob. It's saying that if you're like Jacob and you depend on God, he will vindicate you in the end, in the same way that I think the prophets are giving voice to the feeling of abandon and manipulation. But Ezekiel is saying that Yahweh was close to them while mm-hmm. they're in exile, that they can turn to him because he will vindicate them. He is reliable, and he will defeat the false gods that are around them.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah, this story is such a rich narrative. There are so many details, but ultimately, it's a call to trust the God who vindicates his people and his promises. Shane, this has been a delightful conversation. Thank you for taking some time to follow up from your sermon and talk through this text with me.
Thanks for having me.
This has been another episode of the Resurrection Church Podcast. This podcast is a ministry of Resurrection Church in Burnsville, Minnesota. You can find us online at resurrectionmn.org. And if you'd like to watch this podcast recording instead of just listen to it, you can go over to our YouTube channel. And of course, you can drop in and visit us in person at any time.